Mutiny Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome and hello to our program, The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and can also be heard live streaming on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110, but as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest today is the world-renowned historian and author Andrew Roberts, and our subject on the anniversary of the end of the Second World War is his masterful study, Masters and Commanders, which analyzes the creation, coordination, and operations of the supreme leadership of the Allied Command in the European Theater of Operations, which authored the defeat of the Axis powers in Europe and basically established the special relationship, the special friendship that still exists today with the British. Welcome, Andrew, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much indeed, Richard. It's an honor to be invited.
Thank you. Andrew Roberts is a graduate of Gonville and Gaius College of Cambridge University, where he's an honorary senior scholar. His biographies of World War II Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax, entitled Holy Fox, was published in 1991. It was followed by a number of terrific books, The Eminent Churchillians, which also books on Napoleon Wellington, Hitler and Churchill, Secrets of Leadership. He has been regularly featured on British television and radio. He writes for the Sunday Telegraph and reviews history books and biography for that newspaper, as well as The Spectator, The Literary Review, Mail on Sunday, The Daily Telegraph. It goes on and on. He's been involved with, many, many things. Because in recent times, he published Waterloo, Napoleon's Last Gamble, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples Since 1900. That brought him an invitation to speak at the White House in 2007, where he delivered the prestigious White House lecture. His book, Masters and Commanders, which was published in 2008, won the Emery Reeves Award for International Churchill Society and was shortlisted for the Duke of Westminster's Gold Medal Military History and the British Army Military Award, both of Britain's two top military history prizes. He's interested in public policy, which this program's about. He sits on the boards of a number of think tanks and is the director of the Harry Guggenheim Foundation in New York. He's also been elected as a fellow of the Napoleonic Institute, an honorary member of the International Churchill Society of the United Kingdom, and he's a trustee of the Margaret Thatcher Archive Trust and the Roberts Foundation. Andrew, that's a lot to handle, and I can imagine it's tough to keep track also.
just hearing it from you makes me exhausted.
Right. I could have gone on and on, but we have more to talk about. Yeah. You know, this past week marks the 65th anniversary of the surrender of Japan and the end of World War II. On December 8th of 1941, a day, as FDR said, which will live in infamy, half the U.S. Pacific fleet lay mired in the mud of Pearl Harbor. The Philippines were under attack, and the whole Pacific Rim was in jeopardy, and Australia was worried about defending its western frontier. In Europe, the Nazi panzers were threatening Leningrad, Moscow, the Ukraine, Stalingrad, the Russian oil reserves in the Caucasus. In other words, the whole European continent was dominated by Nazi Germany, its allies, and its friends. With this daunting scenario, Winston Churchill would meet FDR over Christmas in Washington, D.C., their first meeting since their historic Atlantic Conference in Argentia Bay, not where the Atlantic Charter came from. Could you describe the criticality of that first meeting after Pearl Harbor, when the Europe First strategy evolved, and how this great partnership with FDR and Churchill began?
Well, yes, you're right. It couldn't have been a more critical and dangerous time for America in the Pacific and Britain, of course, in Europe, and for the Russians, who had a grueling 900-day siege at Leningrad, and as you mentioned, the prospect of future attacks taking place further south, with the Germans actually on the on the cusp of taking Moscow. So it was a vital and nerve-wracking time. But such was the leadership and the abilities of these two great men, Winston Churchill and FDR, and also their military commanders, their advisors, senior advisors, George Marshall and General Sir Alan Brooke. These men were giants of the day. They were able to see the war in its larger strategic concept. And so they stuck to this policy of Germany first. Germany was going to be defeated before Japan. Despite the enormous domestic advantages, political advantages, that Roosevelt could have taken by attacking Japan first, which of course was the power that had attacked you, the Americans. And yet they stuck to this incredibly statesmanlike and, in the as it turned out, correct policy of smashing Hitler before then turning the might of the world onto Japan.
You know, eventually this strategy had to be developed and put into action beyond their meetings in Washington. Both countries' supreme commands had to be put together, and obviously cooperation was essential, and that's what you discuss. How does your book, Masters and Commanders, address these complexities, and who were the commanders? In other words, how did Marshall and Brooke emerge as FDR and Churchill's choices?
George Marshall had emerged before the war broke out. He became the U.S. Army Chief of Staff on the 1st of September 1939, which was the actual day of Hitler's invasion of Poland. And was a superb choice. He was a courtly Pennsylvanian gentleman, a man of immense capacity for work, somebody who said what he thought, and was a fine strategic brain too. Alan Brooke didn't really emerge until the March of 1942. He became chief of the Imperial General Staff in December 1941. But then he became chairman of the Chiefs of Staff in March 1942. He was a flinty Irishman, an Ulsterman. He was as tough as boots. He was a very... he would sit in front of Winston Churchill, breaking pencils in half, saying, "No, I disagree with you, Prime Minister." And both Roosevelt and Churchill were big enough men to appoint people who would disagree with them in a way that sometimes politicians don't do today. They were confident enough of their own intellectual abilities to be able to appoint the men who they thought were best rather than the ones who would be yes men to them.
No doubt that's very critical. You know, within the military leadership of these two great democracies, there were natural differences over strategy, their spheres of influence, their long-range objectives. With that in mind, why do you think the four masters and commanders' interrelationship was so critical for success?
So critical because although each of them felt that they knew the way in which victory could be won, they needed to get the other two, at least two of the others, on side. And so throughout the war, these four men played a complicated minuet, sometimes the Americans on one side against the British, sometimes the generals against the politicians, sometimes one individual would be out on a limb. But if he was, he knew that his strategy would not be adopted. And so there was this very complicated way in which they interacted with each other to ensure that their way of winning the war was adopted.
Yeah. And of course, just let me remind our audience, we're talking to Andrew Roberts, the historian, author of Masters and Commanders. We're talking about FDR, Churchill, Field Marshal Alan Brooke, George C. Marshall, names that are quite well known to most Americans. And remember, when these differences that the public may not be aware of, it wasn't only just defeating the Axis. It was the ideas of colonies, spheres of influence, India, Hong Kong, the Middle East oil, the Monroe Doctrine, isolation, and all this affected the political dynamics of both countries. You know, American top military leadership in 1942 did not have the concept of the Joint Chiefs. Top brass like Admiral Ernest King, General Henry Arnold, and George C. Marshall basically reported to FDR's unofficial chief of staff, Admiral Leahy. King was also known as incredibly anti-British. What were the meetings really like, and how did Marshall and Brooke handle their jealous rivals and their peers?
Well, Well, they got very tough. The meetings would sometimes descend into shouting matches. You would have, as I say, Churchill having pencils broken in half in his face. At other stages, General Wedemeyer said that he wanted to lean across and sock Brooke in the jaw at one meeting. They were tough, hard-fought meetings. But as the British historian Ronald Lewin wrote, you know, there's no rule of law that says that men can die on the battlefield, but that staff officers shouldn't be vexed. They were vexed, and understandably so, because the decisions these men were taking would lead directly to the deaths of tens of thousands, on occasion hundreds of thousands of people. So, of course, it was vital to get the right decision, and tempers did flare up. But the great thing was that Marshall and Brooke were able, even though they did not see eye to eye strategically very much at the time, they were able to clear the room of all the junior staff officers and the hangers-on and stenographers and so on, and come to an agreement every time on the 10 great moments when they met at the conferences such as Tehran and Yalta and Casablanca and so on. They always managed to come up with a plan for victory before they went to their political masters, Roosevelt and Churchill, and so they were able to haggle, effectively, to horse trade.
You know, it's interesting, and you brought up, and I'm a decently well-read on this subject since probably the age of 12, and the interesting thing is the remarks stated by the British commanders in terms of Churchill's personality, that he drank, that he was wild, he was inconsistent, wherein with Roosevelt you don't hear that from Marshall or the other commanders. There's a much different level of respect. Internally, it seems the British commanders are very critical of Churchill's personality.
It all goes back to the First World War. It goes back to the Gallipoli campaign of 1915, when Churchill had, against the advice of his military advisors, attacked the Dardanelles and got involved in a campaign that got nowhere at the cost of tens of thousands of Allied lives. And so really that was the moment that even 25 years later was looked back to by many of the senior soldiers, airmen and sailors in the Second World War, on the basis that Churchill must not be allowed to do such a thing again. And to give Churchill his due, he did learn his lesson of Gallipoli.
Right.
He never once overruled the chiefs of staff on a military matter during the whole of the Second World War.
But he always was interested in coming back to the soft underbelly of the Axis, and we'll get into that in a little while. You know, we're all familiar with theater commanders like Eisenhower, Clark, and field commanders like Montgomery, Bradley, and Patton. They were all in the heat of the action. From your perspective, weren't commanders like Eisenhower, Montgomery, Bradley, and Patton more important to winning the war?
No, I don't believe they were for a moment. I think the really important decisions, the ones that won the war, the ones about where was attacked, where was invaded, what time, by how many troops, in what areas of the world, these, the grand strategic decisions, were the ones that won the war. They then handed them over, of course, to, as the gentleman that you mentioned, the great generals that you just listed. But really, their job was just to make sure that the actual fighting on the ground went successfully, as it did. But when it came to the really big decisions of the Second World War, they weren't taken by Eisenhower, Montgomery, Patton, and the others. They were taken by Brooke and by Marshall in smoke-filled rooms in these great conferences.
And, of course, you know, people worried here, why didn't the American troops get into Berlin first, etc., and we all know that it had been decided. The boundaries of the occupation of the four powers, the Soviet Union, United States, Britain, and then France, which was carved out of the British and American zones, that was all decided, and if the Americans had gone into Berlin, they would have had to give up the territory anyhow. It's very interesting that was used as a political tool, after the war. You know, most World War II historians, which predated the official release of the State Secrets Acts and requirements regarding the breaking of the German military codes by the Enigma machine, which information was known as magic, were quite incomplete. And since 1970, most of those secrets are now public information. I think Higginbottom wrote about it in his book, The Ultra Secret. He was the first to bring it out. With all that release of information over the past 40 years, how did your book draw on new sources?
Well, I was very fortunate. I mean, it was an act of pure serendipity, luck, really, that one day when I was in the Churchill Archive in Cambridge University, my train was late and I had a bit of time on my hands. I purely by luck managed to stumble across the entire verbatim account of Winston Churchill's war cabinets, which had never been seen by any historians before. They had been they'd been taken by the stenographer, the man who'd been taking shorthand at the cabinet meetings, and he'd taken them home every day after war cabinet meetings, completely against the rules of the Official Secrets Act. He could have been arrested if anybody had worked out what he was doing.
He would have been the man in the iron mask.
Exactly that. A man called Lawrence Burgess, and who nobody, history had never heard of before until I found these papers that had been left by the executors of his will to Churchill College, and nobody had bothered to check them out. Understandably so, in a sense, because they were written in hieroglyphics. They were in shorthand. He had a very bad handwriting. It wasn't easy to work out what they were at the beginning. But as soon as I did work out, I discovered that they were the verbatim account, every single word said in Winston Churchill's war cabinet. So it was a sort of treasure trove of information about the way in which Churchill interacted with his soldiers and with other politicians. And it forms the backbone, as you can imagine, of my book.
And, of course, that's what's so interesting. As a person who has been reading about FDR for, I don't know, close to over 50 years and who has been collecting FDR memorabilia, 400 books on FDR, the messages between FDR and his people aren't around. You know, there's a terrific book on FDR and Churchill called Men of Secrets.
Yeah.
In truth, FDR really was the man of secrets. And and in your book, you have all this interaction, all this, ebb and flow between the characters, the people around Churchill. But in Roosevelt, it's like separate. You know what I mean? There's Roosevelt.
That's absolutely right. He actually told when there was a meeting early on when George Marshall had a man come in and to take notes in order to ensure that there was a record of the meeting and also so that they would know who had decided to do what as a result of the meeting. And FDR, with some anger, told the young lieutenant to put away his notebook and to put his pen back in his pocket.
Oh, yeah. Roosevelt always said many times, he said, if you have something important to say, don't write it down.
That's right. And exactly. We have that a little bit with what we call sofa government in Britain, where people sit on the sofa and chat to one another, but they don't write emails, they don't write notes, because they fear later on it'll be used against them.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, Roosevelt talked to Leahy, and we could talk a little bit about later on, if we get some time, about how the Joint Chiefs evolved out of that. But, in fact, that Roosevelt didn't even want Leahy, William D. Leahy, a retired admiral, very well respected, to be considered the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He didn't even want that.
No, that's right. He didn't want to have a single figure who he felt might unite the chiefs, obviously, against him.
Right.
And so it was all a power play. Obviously, nobody understands power better than the president. He really was a politician to his fingertips. And so the last thing he wanted was even a man like Leahy, who liked Roosevelt very much. He'd served as his as an aide-de-camp to him years before. He was obviously a friend, but even he wasn't going to be allowed to hold this position of power and responsibility.
And Marshall, who historically held the place of the Army Chief of Staff longer than any man before or since, 6 years, he becomes the first of equals amongst them. He sort of evolves into that role. Is that correct?
Very much, very much. He was, not least because he was the only man who seemed to be able to command the respect of Ernest King, a rebarbative figure, obviously a very great admiral in the history of the United States, but as you mentioned in your introduction, a terrible Anglophobe, and therefore somebody who it was going to be very dangerous to have in close proximity in strategic decision making with the British chiefs of staff. So what Marshall was able to do was to placate King to get what he needed through Leahy and also to deal with the British. And that, of course, is at the same time as building an American army that was tiny in 1939 and numbered 8 million or so in 1945.
Sure, no question. And it's very interesting that Eisenhower, of course, there's a couple of reasons why people believe Eisenhower was selected basically by FDR through Marshall. Marshall wanted, and we'll talk about a little bit about the loyalty or the lack of loyalty of Eisenhower in the post-war era, but it's interesting that Eisenhower had a German name, which they wanted, and Eisenhower also was able to get along with people, especially the British. We're coming up against our commercial break. I want to remind our audience they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 and live streaming on WVOX with Richard Garfunkel, myself. My guest is author and historian Andrew Roberts. We're discussing his book, Masters and Commanders, about FDR, Churchill, and their two top commanders, General George C. Marshall and Field Marshal Alan Brooke, and the strategy that was created to win the war in Europe. When we come back after the break, I'm going to ask Andrew Roberts this question. What were the most important disagreements on strategy between the British and Americans? We'll be back in a moment or so. Thank you.
We make it very easy for you to get on the air and talk to your neighbors.
Could someone talk to me?
And the world.
This station is now the ultimate power in the universe.
The podium is yours.
Impressive.
AM 1460 and worldwide at WVOX.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lori London. President Obama is at Joe's house, not Joe the plumber, Joe the architect. The commander-in-chief chatting it up with the Columbus, Ohio resident's family and neighbors.
Thank you for doing such a wonderful job.
Well, thank you.
The president touting his administration's efforts to jumpstart the economy, but admits recovery is slow.
All these things have made a difference, but we've still got a long way to go.
Next up for the president, fundraisers in both Columbus, Miami, and in Miami, Florida. Conflicting stories trickling in between whistleblower WikiLeaks and the Pentagon.
U.S. Army spokesman denying a claim by WikiLeaks that it is talking with the General Counsel over possible U.S. Army help in releasing new leaked documents. Last month, critics called that website reckless, endangering Americans and Afghans by releasing tens of thousands of war records.
Fox Radio's Alistair Wanklin, WikiLeaks founder, says he and the world has a right to know, and he'll publish more soon. Fox News. We report, you decide.
Today's public service programs are brought to you by the Burnback Law Firm of White Plains. This famous Manhattan law firm, now in Westchester, is a national leader in workplace job discrimination issues. Headed by attorney Jeffrey M. Burnback, the author of the well-known book, Job Discrimination, How to Fight, How to Win, the classic text informing employees of legal options available in cases of job discrimination, the Burnback Law Firm is located in downtown White Plains at 245 Main Street across from City Center. Airline founder Don Burr says Jeff Burnback's overview and knowledge of job discrimination ranks with other sweeping visions of employee empowerment. Another reviewer said, as a lawyer and public servant, Jeff Burnback has been drawn relentlessly, almost irresistibly, to the side of those who faced discrimination in all its forms. His entire life and law practice are dedicated to those who find themselves without an advocate when the roof caves in at work. Now, all this great knowledge, dedication, and expertise is available in our area at the Burnback Law Firm in White Plains. 914-428-9100. Area code 914-428-9100.
New Jersey blueberries. They're fresh, great to eat, and they're here. Blueberries are a great source of vitamin A and C, and they're just 41 calories for a half cup serving. Besides all that, blueberries are delicious, and New Jersey blueberries are simply the best. New Jersey blueberries are juicy and sweet, great in pies, muffins, pancakes, yogurt, ice cream, or just by themselves. Let your imagination decide how to enjoy New Jersey blueberries. Remember, Jersey fresh blueberries only come around once a year, and they don't last very long. So buy them and enjoy them now. You can even freeze them and enjoy them later. Go to your favorite supermarket and get some Jersey Fresh blueberries. It's a summer fruit treat that doesn't last very long, but they're so good. New Jersey blueberries, sweet, juicy, and delicious. Enjoy them now while they last. Courtesy of the New Jersey blueberry grower.
In the north end of New Rochelle, you'll find an absolutely top-notch printer, one of the very best in the entire county. Frank Maselli's Minuteman Press is known for its fine work far beyond the Sound Shore area. In fact, this particular Minuteman Press is easily the class of the fleet when it comes to full-service community printers. Located just off North Avenue in New Rochelle in the narrow Waikagill walkway across the parking lot from the A&P, Frank Maselli's Minuteman Press is a terrific resource for individuals and small to medium-sized companies who want something very special when it comes to printing. No matter how big or how small your needs, you get great skill and creativity from Maestro Maselli's master printers, all for very reasonable prices. From business cards to brochures, color copies, high-speed printing, informational booklets, and flyers, it's Minuteman Press down that walkway when you're heading to the A&P, offering quality printing at very good prices. Call Frank Maselli at Minuteman Press of New Rochelle, 914-576-0335. 914-576-0335.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates. I'm talking to historian and author Andrew Roberts about his book, Masters and Commanders, that reflects the strategy that was created to win World War II in Europe. Before the break, I asked him the following question: what were the most important disagreements on strategy between the British and Americans? And before he answers, there he's got a choice of the Second Front, Greece, North Africa, Sicily, Italy, the invasion of Marseille, Calais, or Normandy, unconditional surrender, carpet bombing, versus strategic daylight raids, the partitioning of Germany. In other words, there's a lot on the table, Andrew. What were some of the major disagreements?
Well, as you say, you have actually gone through all of them there very correctly there. But the really massive one was the first one you mentioned, the Second Front. At what stage and in what force was what we know as D-Day going to take place? Were we going to go there as early as Marshall wanted, which was in 1942, in the autumn, the fall of 1942? Or were we going to put it off, as the British wanted to do, until the summer of 1944? And really, the biggest disagreements, the most important ones, came from this, because FDR supported Churchill and Brooke against his own Army Chief of Staff Marshall until the Trident Conference in Washington in May 1943, when it was ordained that Operation Overlord was going to take place in the on the 1st of May 1944. It was then put back 6 weeks for reasons to do with landing craft. But basically, that was the point at which the Americans insisted on having an Anglo-American army, a big one, a 50 divisional attack, on the crossing the channel in 1944.
Now, you know, reflective of those differences, Winston Churchill seemed to be obsessed with two thoughts of attacking the soft underbelly of the Axis, Greece and the Balkans, where British had interest, affording him a possible redemption of what you had mentioned earlier as his disastrous World War I Gallipoli operation, whose failure caused his dismissal as the First Lord of the Admiralty, along with the fear of huge losses regarding an early cross-channel attack on what is historically called Festung Europa, the Fortress Europe. in the Nazi-controlled continent. FDR wanted a more direct and frontal assault on Europe, and this is nuanced between Marshall wanting to do it quickly, Roosevelt understanding the British position that we weren't ready, but not particularly accepting the British idea that it would be piece by piece. How did the strategy evolve to North Africa first, Sicily, etc.? How did that evolve?
Well, it evolved really in a piecemeal way. At each of these meetings, they worked out where they were going to attack next, and it was really the Casablanca meeting of January 1943 that it was agreed that American and British forces were going to attack Sicily. Even whilst the Italian, the Sicilian campaign was going on, they hadn't agreed yet to go on to the bottom of the toe of Italy and fight up Italy. So, I mean, this was a very much each conference was had the next stage of the war on the agenda, and they had to argue it out every single time. Mm. And so, as you say, FDR did want the cross-channel attack. But he was persuaded by Brooke and Churchill that until the Battle of the Atlantic had been won, until there was sufficient forces in southern England to cross over in overwhelming victory, could be assured, until the war in the air had been turned against the Luftwaffe, which didn't really happen until late 1943, then an attack, an over-hasty crossing of the Channel, could end in disaster.
As it did at Dieppe. In other words, when they had attempted a small, you could call it raid in force, obviously tiny in comparison to Overlord and the Normandy invasion, Dieppe was a total disaster.
Total disaster. Of the 5,100 Canadians that landed there, over 3,000 were killed or captured or wounded. It was one of the terrible disasters of the war. A lot of this can be put down. I've written about this at some earlier books. A lot of this could be put down, quite frankly, to the appalling intelligence operations that Lord Mountbatten was responsible for. And as you say, it was a much, much smaller operation, of course, than even the first day of D-Day. But nonetheless, it did show that the Germans had a good deal of fight in them.
Yeah. You know, the Western Allies knew that they could not defeat Germany alone without massive aid to and from the Soviet Union. America was therefore committed to supply Russia with almost unlimited lend-lease supplies. But a second front, as we've been discussing, was needed, and it was essential to divert German divisions from the Eastern Front. You know, I mean, that was part of the help that the Soviet Union, Stalin, wanted. Was this second front not done? Why was the second front not done directly, in other words, launched through northern France or the Balkans, but through North Africa, Sicily, and Italy? How did the Allies see that? Is it because they felt these were easier victories to attain and this could bleed their supplies?
That's right, and divert the German forces down into the Mediterranean theater, where it would be easier for us to be able to use the Royal Navy, of course, which was superior to the German Navy. And we were also going to be able to divert troops away from where the final thrust was always going to take place, which was northwest France. So by attacking in Italy, it was hoped that the Germans would be diverted from where the true hammer blow was going to take place, which was, of course, crossing the Channel and trying to stop Hitler from being able to control the Ruhr and his war industry.
Now, let me ask you a question. In reflective of the Soviet Union's reaction to Allied efforts in North Africa and Mediterranean, was there a greater pressure on Roosevelt and Churchill? Did it descend to Marshall and Brooke? Were they aware of those, the political end? I don't think Marshall was exactly.
Yes, they were both made very clearly aware by Stalin, not least, directly, especially in the meeting in Moscow in August 1942, of Russia's desperate need to have the pressure drawn off the Soviet Union. I think it's worth remembering, in fact, for me, it's the central statistic of the Second World War, in fact, that for every 5 Germans killed in conflict, by which I mean on the battlefield rather than being bombed from the air. 4 of them died on the Eastern Front. British and Americans, really were responsible for killing the 5th German, as it were. And
right.
So it's very important not to get this out of perspective. You know, the war was won or lost on the Eastern Front. And so any help that we were able to give, but the great help that we were able to give, which is very often forgotten, ignored, or downplayed, and certainly was by the Russians in the post-war period, was the fact that with our combined bomber offensive against the German cities in 1942 to 1945, some 70% of the Luftwaffe, which would have been invaluable on the Eastern Front, had to be concentrated in defending against our bombing campaign.
No question. I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460. We're live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest, author and historian Andrew Roberts, we're talking about his most interesting book, Masters and Commanders, and the background story of FDR, Winston Churchill, and the two top commanders, Alan Brooke and George C. Marshall. We have to go to a short break. We'll be back in a moment or two with Andrew Roberts.
And national news 3 times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. One neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio, getting a rare backyard visit.
I have been adamant in saying that Social Security should not be privatized, and it will not be privatized as long as I'm president.
President Obama speaking on the economy and other issues after holding a sit-down with one family the White House says was helped by the administration's economic policies.
This family is really a poster child for some of the issues of the recession that were addressed by some of the president's projects. Joe Whiteman is an architect. The bottom really dropped out of his business last year. Rhonda Whiteman lost her job, and with that went the kids' health insurance. The president was able to point to how it had helped the Whitemans.
Fox's Wendell Goller, AP, reporting that a government-ordered review discovered crime lab evidence errors in 190 North Carolina cases, including 3 executions. Fox News, we report, you decide.
There are 2 major candidates for governor of New York. Career politician Andrew Cuomo supports the construction of a $100 million Islamic mosque near Ground Zero. Businessman Carl Paladino opposes a mosque near the site of the 9/11 attack on America and questions the true sources of the mosque's funding. Andrew Cuomo says it's about religious freedom and the construction of the mosque should proceed. Carl Paladino says it's an affront to those murdered on 9/11. It's an insult to all Americans, and it must be stopped.
This is Carl Paladino. As governor, I will use the power of eminent domain to stop this mosque and make the site a war memorial instead of a monument to those who attacked our country.
The choice is clear. Paladino for governor.
Paid for by Paladino for the people.
Today's public affairs and issue-oriented community programs are brought to you by the Westchester Law Firm of Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss. This highly regarded regional firm handles matrimonial law and difficult family issues like separation, divorce, alimony, custody, and reconciliation, and is widely known for the caring personal interest and compassion its highly skilled attorneys bring to this most sensitive area of the law. Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, located in the heart of downtown White Plains in the Clarence Rappelier Building at 123 Main Street. The firm is led to this day by managing partner Henry Berman, a former chairman of the family law section of the prestigious New York State Bar Association. For a confidential consultation about matrimonial matters and family law issues, you're invited to call Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, a professional corporation of highly qualified lawyers handling matrimonial law in White Plains at 123 Main Street, 914-997-7100. The Westchester Law Firm with the statewide reputation. Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, 914-997-7100.
Ron, that completes your orientation at Sagona Industries. Just one thing, though. Sneakers are not office attire.
Quite the contrary, Joan. The right footwear is essential to my job. I'll be running to the fax machine, leaping to the printer, racing to the scanner, cornering at high speed to beat my office mates to the copier.
Ron, we have a Canon Image Runner 400. You won't need to leave your desk. You'll use the network to manage copying, printing, faxing, scanning, and sophisticated document finishing at up to 40 pages per minute.
But I do very thick reports.
Right.
Won't I need adequate ankle support to work the really big industrial-sized stapler?
No.
Dashing to the bindery for saddle-stitched booklets?
Ron, our Canon Image Runner 400 makes all the saddle-stitched booklets you want.
Oh, then I have time to run for a cup of coffee.
Like the wind, Ron.
For more on the Canon Image Runner, call George and Bob Forsbauer's Vista Business Products at 914-347-7888 or visit us on the web at www.vistacanon.com.
WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with Andrew Roberts. We've been talking about his book, Masters and Commanders, and the strategy regarding the Allied victory in World War II. There was, to follow up the last segment, Andrew, there was a great deal of disagreement between the British and the American staffs and leadership over Operation Anvil Dragoon, the invasion of southern France in August of 1944, 2 months after Normandy. How was this disagreement ultimately resolved, and why was there this opposition to the invasion of southern France?
The opposition was really because southern France was 500 miles south of Paris, where the action was. The crux of the campaign was going to be. And so why do you land nearly half a million men, I think it was over 400,000 certainly, 2 months after D-Day, when the fighting is taking place so far north? It's true that we captured a good number of Germans, I think 100,000 of them, fairly swiftly. And it did, of course, liberate southern France. But frankly, that was going to be liberated anyway once German forces were withdrawn back into the Reich. So it was something that British policymakers, strategy makers, were very against, but which the Americans, who by that stage of the war very much had the whip hand, were able to insist upon.
And, of course, there was a need for landing craft and the logistics of it, and it took a lot of the fleet action away from Italy, which was still obviously struggling along. Though Rome had been liberated, I believe, a day or so.
The day before D-Day, yeah.
Right, exactly. So it's an interesting thing that the spheres of influence, you know, were out to playing out here. Obviously, the British were very, very interested in the Mediterranean. You know, there's been a great deal of controversy over the strategy, and we touched on this for a second, regarding which powers, Western or Soviet, would be first to Berlin, Vienna, and Prague, along with the enduring debates over Yalta. Who determined this policy regarding the liberation of these capitals, and was Yalta really an admission of Soviet power and the continued need for Allied cooperation?
Well, yes, it certainly was, and you know, the Red Army had 9 million men. They were only 40 miles or so away from Berlin by February 1945. They crossed the Vistula. It was you have to, unfortunately, face the realpolitik of who had boots on the ground, and the answer to that was the Red Army. Now, they then lost a staggering number of men capturing Berlin. They took nearly 800,000 casualties in the battle for Berlin. Were the Western democracies genuinely going to be able to fight a battle like that? I mean, that is many more than both Britain and America lost together in the whole of the Second World War, just in one battle alone. So when people talk rather airily, especially after the war, about why the race for Berlin, was it really a race that we genuinely wanted to have to wade in blood to win?
And of course,
the answer is no.
And of course, Berlin had already been determined to be in the Soviet
sphere. Well,
that's
right. This is the key thing, really, that the agreements between the Russians and the West were all demarked out long before. before we got to Yalta anyhow. And they made sense, you know. It was a vast. When one looks at what the Red Army achieved at the time in August 1944 of their Operation Bagration, where they killed or wounded no fewer than 380,000 Germans in one campaign alone, one can understand that these battles. They dwarfed anything that was going on in the West, apart from D-Day itself.
Right. You know, of course, and even the Battle of the Bulge, which was the greatest battle the United States fought and the greatest amount of casualties, only took, out of the 100,000 casualties, approximately 18,000 dead. Not to denigrate those numbers and 15,000 captured, but in comparison to the Battle of Kursk and many of the battles that had evolved in the Eastern Front, it was tiny. It was,
Of course. I mean, the four battles of Kiev... for example, which only Second World War buffs really know about, frankly, they killed and wounded over 10 times that number.
Right. You know, it's also interesting when we discuss this about the Yalta, and I just want to make one thing. Roosevelt, sort of in an offhanded moment, plaintively said, "We got what we could get."
Well, that's right. And actually, let's not denigrate what we did get. We
right.
got the Soviet promise of to declare war against Japan 3 months after the defeat of Germany, which they did do. We got them to take part in the United Nations Association. We've got them to make promises, admittedly promises that were very soon broken over the independence and integrity of Poland. You know, they were the winners at Yalta, but they did have this enormous army in Poland at the time, right. and also in East Prussia.
And no power on earth was going to force them out at that time. And the atomic bomb was not known whether it was worked, and no one was going to use it anyhow.
Of course, yeah. They were our courageous allies. If we had tried to threaten the atomic bomb. Even once it had worked against the Soviet forces, which were at that time unbelievably popular in Britain and America because of this terrible bloodletting that they'd had to suffer, there would have been riots in the streets.
Yeah, it would have been ridiculous. You know, we're coming to a close here. A critical question. Strategically, both FDR and Churchill had vast experience and knowledge of the world of their day, no doubt. Two of the great masters of politics and warfare in history. They were both involved deeply in the prosecution of World War I, and they had years of political experience. From your perspective, from writing this book, who was the stronger partner? Who had the greater vision? And of the four principles, who was raised or lowered in your estimation?
George Marshall was raised in my estimation. He comes over as a very great gentleman as well as a great statesman. The person who got his way again and again was FDR. He was the man, of course, who hadn't studied strategy in the same way that Churchill had at Sandhurst or that Marshall had at the Virginia Military Institute and that Brooke, of course, also had on the general staff. But he was the person who was able to insist in 1943 that the cross-channel attack took place when it did, not a moment too soon, but also not a moment too early.
Mm.
And that itself was a very great thing. I think it's well worth remembering that by 1944, we the British produced 28,000 warplanes, the Germans and Russians produced 40,000 warplanes each, but America produced 98,000 warplanes, almost as much as the whole of the rest of the world put together.
Mm.
And therefore, as a result, of course, Roosevelt was going to have the final say.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because many people say, how is the world, in whose vision is the modern post-World War II world? And of course, most people understand that it's in the FDR vision, not the Churchill vision. Both were removed from the scene, unfortunately, FDR by death on April 12, 1945, and Churchill by election right during the Potsdam Conference. It's amazing ironies that these great personalities were removed from the scene quite quickly. I want to thank you, Andrew Roberts, for joining the Advocates today. And before we end, could you tell our audience what your next project is and when it'll be out?
Yes, my next project is called The Storm of War. It's a single-volume history of the Second World War, and hopefully it's going to be out next fall, the fall of 2011.
And hopefully I'll be around, you'll be around.
I'd love to come back on your show. Yeah. It's fascinating. I must say, we don't in England have shows of such intellectual rigor that go on for so long. And so thank you very much indeed. I've hugely enjoyed it, Rich.
My pleasure. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them at my website, advocates-wvox, where the information on my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll be discussing the subject of dynasty and generation-skipping trusts with Boston College professor Ray Madoff and the rising power of the American dead. It's a big public policy issue that's going to come forward with the new tax laws. Thank you, Andrew, again for joining us. It was a wonderful hour.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day for everyone out there. Thanks a lot.